Alrighty, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to I Eat Movies number 4. How have we been doing this for 4 episodes already? It feels like a lifetime.
I bet it feels longer to anybody who's been listening to us.
Oh,
but
dear.
This is a new concept we're going to try in a shorter format episode. This is I hope you're okay with this. I'm referring to this as Mike's first time.
Yes.
I hope to do Dino's first time as well, but this is Mike's first time on Harlem Nights tonight. I'll get into my relationship with this movie if I can even say I have one, but I know this movie and Mike did not. And therefore you just watched it what, 2 days ago?
At the time of this recording, yeah, I think it was about 2 days ago. I had known about this film because I think what we mentioned at the tail end of our Paul Winfield episode, I'm a huge Eddie Murphy fan. But as with anybody who's a big cinephile or considers themselves a cinephile, you're always going to have gaps in any form of your like cinematic journeys. So this was one that it always kind of astonished me that I hadn't seen, because this really comes from like the peak decade for Eddie Murphy. So it was always weird that this one evaded me, but a real perfect topic to tackle for quote unquote Mike's first time.
I mean, to me, this is kind of where I think his career ends, maybe. That's a bit dramatic, but shall we just dive right in? I guess
I think we can dive into this. I mean, before we properly dive into the film that we are going to be tackling today, it is an interesting sort of bookend to what you could consider the peak Eddie Murphy decade. Of course, you know, this is Harlem Nights, which was released in 1989. Before tackling it, we do want to talk about the man himself, Eddie Murphy, because as much as some of our listeners might think that this was intentional, this was kind of a coincidence that we're celebrating and discussing Harlem Nights not more than a week removed from Eddie's most recent movie coming to America being released, which we'll have a few few thoughts on that one a little bit, I think.
It is out already. I haven't seen it.
Yeah, it came out last Thursday. Amazon Prime ended up releasing it a day early, and I watched it on the Friday. And it's not quite the original, but I will say that everybody in that film is having an absolute blast in it, just having a great time. It's a reunion movie, you know, it's a reunion movie. Everybody is absolutely happy to be back in those roles. But there's just something missing about it, I think. It's just not quite up to snuff that the John Landis original film is, of course. But before we get into Harlem Nights, I think that it's important to just talk about Eddie Murphy being such a legend that he is. I mean, the guy's got an incredible career, a really interesting early upbringing. You know, he was born in Brooklyn, later raised in Roosevelt Heights. Murphy's parents, this is what I thought was very interesting, they split up, and his father was actually later killed in a crime of passion, in what Murphy describes it as. And then his mother remarried a little later on. But before that, before his mother remarried, she actually fell ill, and him and his brother Charlie were actually put in foster care for a year. And it's that moment that Eddie has always claimed that was incredibly influential in developing his sense of humor. So, you know, just right from the get-go, like, talk about a rough hand being dealt to you and being put in a situation like that as a kid, but then really finding sort of like the light, you know, sort of the positive in it. And clearly there was much to it. From there, he later began his comedy career in 76 at the ripe old age of 15, which is just absolutely unfathomable.
It's the same age that Gilbert started, actually.
Isn't that crazy that these
Gilbert Gottfried.
Yeah, the great Gilbert Gottfried, of course. Yeah, it is crazy that guys like, you know, Gottfried and Murphy were coming up at an age like that, but it's sensational, you know, of course, seeing what they ascended to. I'm sure it's no surprise to listeners or fans of Eddie Murphy, but, you know, obviously his influencers ranged from people like Richard Pryor and Bill Cosby, Red Fox, Robin Williams, and interestingly enough, even Charlie Chaplin. So it goes to show you that Eddie Murphy was really zeroed into a whole wide gamut of comedic performers, really picking up on, you know, things here and things there, really taking from, you know, really people that we would consider like the masters of comedy, I think, you know. Oh, please.
No, I just no, I it, the other reason why Harlem Nights is because I did find out what 2 months ago, a month ago, that you had never seen it, and I've
Yeah.
pretty much been pestering you about it ever since.
Yes.
But so yeah, so this is at this is from 89. This is after some of his biggest movies. And okay, well, I'm just gonna go personal. What the hell?
Please.
For me, before I was, see, I know a lot of guys who were diehard movie fans when they were little kids, to the point where, I mean, some of these guys are now podcasters, authors, what have you.
Yeah.
And they've kept insane records on the movies that they watched as a kid. And I wasn't that person, but I've kind of always isolated this like 87 to like 91 era for me as this period that was really important in just the age I was at. So this came out when I was 12 years old. And speaking of the Gilbert podcast, Craig Bierko, the actor Craig Bierko, I think he might be directing too, perhaps. We just so happened to have gone to the same high school, albeit like at least over a decade apart.
Oh,
And
wow.
he just name dropped this theater in December on the Gilbert Gottfried podcast, where he's a regular guest. Myself and two friends of mine, you know, growing who we were both tight buddies growing up, we all went to see Harlem Nights at the Rye Ridge Twin Cinema in Rye Town, New York, which was one of the theaters that I went to growing up. It was rumored to be the theater that caused whoever created Movie Phone originally,
Yeah.
because they were so bad at leaving their listings on the telephone recording or something to that effect. So I went there with two friends, and this is not a particularly black part of the of Westchester County, but it was certainly that night. It was a packed house. It was the most, for a suburban theater, it was the most grindhouse experience I've ever had. It was the most interactive
Wow.
theater experience I've ever had. I just checked with one of my friends who was there that night, and he said anything Red Fox said was cause for the biggest audience reaction, and as well the scene where the scene of Jasmine Guy's demise, when she's shot. But it was to be 12 years old, and it was a startling thing to see a completely interactive shouting back at the screen. Probably about 200 people fit in that theater,
Yeah.
thereabouts, 150, 200. It was twinned at that point. But this theater, by the way, now is the location of a Chipotle,
Oh.
which regularly has a long line of people, which never includes me as a rule. But for me, it was definitely like it came out at the right time. It was an absolutely impossible to forget experience seeing this in the theater, with, people screaming back at the screen. It was a whole complete, like, it's the exact opposite, strangely
Yeah.
enough, of the Alamo experience. We don't,
Sure.
being associated with an Alamo draft house, it's the exact opposite thing. But it was also
Right.
not, it was also I'm presuming this was November, December 1989,
Yeah,
because
yeah.
it came out in November.
Yeah, November 17th it debuted, yeah.
And the thing about this movie, it just, like, to me, no, of course it's not the end of Eddie Murphy's career, but it's as much as a lot of people look at this film as, oh, it wasn't that great, or it wasn't forgettable, or it was forgettable, it got a lot of bad press at the time, I think.
Horrendous press. Horrendous. Yeah. Which we will get into, yeah.
I don't... fuck all that. Honestly, there's so many people that I can walk up to. There's people like the first time I met them, where I could drop a quote from this movie and they pick it up immediately. They're completely right there on it because they like this movie as much as I do. But it's really about the core three male actors. It's really about Eddie Murphy and three generations of comic actors that are just each in their own way, like utterly unique. You know, right. Red Fox, just
absolute pillars of black 100%, like unbelievable
of American entertainment. You know, Richard Pryor, Eddie Murphy, and Red Fox. To me, this movie, you know, it might not be an absolute, you know, cinematic achievement, quote unquote,
right,
but it is.
Beauty, you know, is in the eye of the beholder. Come on.
first of all, like, this is to me, this is really a turning point, not just because it's at the cusp of the end of a decade that makes it seem easy to do, but I really wasn't attracted to that much as a kid at the time that Eddie Murphy did after this. That's one thing. But going back to these, so Richard Pryor, to me, this is probably his last great role.
Oh, because certainly.
He kept acting, but in tiny roles and, like, clearly appearances based on, you know, on who he was.
Yeah.
And this is Red Fox. Not only is this Red Fox's final film, but Red Fox, by and large, I mean, I don't want to paint too negative a picture, but it's like he was basically screwed by the entertainment industry over and over. Mm-hmm. He was in less than five feature films. Did a bit more TV, obviously, Sanford and Son, and he did have a short-lived
The Red Fox Show. Yeah.
The Red Fox Show, which I don't remember seeing. In the recording industry, he did start his own label at one point. I don't think it was hugely successful, called MF Records, when comedy records were a really big deal.
Yeah.
But the recording industry really screwed him over. Like, mm-hmm. It's a bad idea. I love Red Fox to pieces, but it's a bad idea. Because I thought about this back in the 90s. It's a bad idea to try to start collecting Red Fox records, because whoever put out his records, by and large, repackaged the same material over and over and over, and he didn't get paid for it.
Right.
I don't know if it's fair to say that he didn't really get paid until, or he didn't really have significant success until Sanford and Son, but I think that might have been the first time he really had, like, power. He really had a chance to call the shots and whatnot. He was of that generation of, you know, the so-called Chitlin circuit, where he'd gone through so many rough parts of the business. You know, it was a much more divided business back then. In the early part of his career, that he was one of these guys who wanted to be paid before he went on, you know, because
who'd have thought, right?
So in that way, like, it's funny. I watched my copy of this three times in the past week. I still have a video. It's on the Instagram, folks. I still have a videotape copy of this. And I'm perfectly happy with this videotape. I don't think I have the cover anymore, but it plays fine. And there's a sentimental attachment to this movie in that way, I suppose. But I think it's a mid to late 90s videotape issue. Mm-hmm. And I'm going by the trailers on it. The three trailers that start this tape of Harlem Nights are Another 48 Hours, which came out after Paramount, which I haven't gone back to in a while, but the last time I did, I figured it was the last time I was going to see it because 48 Hours is so incredible and it's so much. I mean, that's really like the kind of the starting point of him in movies, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, absolutely. I think while we're comparing it, I think that's top tier, you know, buddy picture material right there for
God, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's a Walter Hill movie that is starting to point towards the way that things would go in the 80s, but it still has a bit of that 70s nastiness to it.
Yeah.
So another 48 hours, then Black Rain, the Ridley Scott movie, which again, just encapsulates this formative period for a young me. I saw in the exact same theater the exact same room in that theater that I saw Harlem Nights in. I remember seeing Black Rain when it first came out.
Now they're making burrito bowls in the same seat that you saw Black Rain and Harlem Nights in.
And then so fitting for the time, the best of Eddie Murphy on Saturday Night Live, with the Don Pardo doing the voiceover for the ad. So, you know, the best of Eddie Murphy, take it home on videotape today. It's so like of its time to me.
You know, in particular too, I really loved Paramount's promotional material on videotapes. I remember watching specifically my Wayne's World VHS a lot in the early 90s, and I always just liked the way Paramount promoted things. And again, like what you were saying, like the narration and everything, it definitely stuck and has left like a permanent imprint on my brain, like that narrator's voice and whatnot. So yeah, definitely memorable material. But ladies and gentlemen, before we really dive deep into 1989's Harlem Nights, it's important to know, just going off of what Dino said, that last trailer promotion was, of course, for Eddie Murphy, the best of Eddie Murphy in Saturday Night Live. He landed SNL when he was 19. Now, I know that there's probably going to be some comparisons to other, you know, younger cast members that joined SNL. I mean, Pete Davidson is one that, you know, a more contemporary one that certainly comes to mind. But I don't think that one person before or since Eddie Murphy has had an impact like he did when he came out. He joined in 1980, and he appeared in four seasons from 80 to 84, which was a very sensitive time in SNL's history. Of course, its creator, Lauren Michaels, leaving during that time, and many of the writers, in a show of loyalty, followed him out the door. So a lot of what made SNL, you know, this gold standard for comedy entertainment was kind of crumbling right before their eyes. And then this kid, this Brooklyn-bound kid, gets cast in this show, and you know, he's sort of been considered the reason for single-handedly helping revitalize the show at a time where, you know, cancellation seemed imminent. And you know, he completely was just this, you know, this lightning shock to this, you know, cultural icon that people were tuning into week after week, with memorable characters like Buckwheat, which, you know, he infamously retired, Mr. Robinson and Gumby. And it's also notable too that
I watched a lot of these live, by the way. Some of them syndicated, but some of them live too.
Yeah, I mean, just, I don't think that anybody, you know, he was hungry. He was a young kid who clearly was hungry and had a very different and unique style that you could see where his influences were coming from. But this was a kid that was definitely shooting from the hip, and there just wasn't anybody quite like Murphy at this time. And it's notable, too, just kind of swinging it back to 48 hours, he was the only cast member to host the show while being a cast member, because originally it was supposed to be Nick Nolte hosting as a way of promotion for 48 hours, but Nolte became ill, so Murphy filled in and he, you know, did his whole introduction to the show and welcomed people to the Eddie Murphy show.
That's amazing.
Which is so great. And then, you know, as we all know, you know, decades went by, and then he infamously returned to SNL to host in December of 2019 to promote for Dolomite Is My Name. Honestly, one of the best guest starring appearances I've seen in several years, I think, on SNL. But, you know, from that point on, it was just a full throttle ascension, I think, for this kid. I mean, you had the HBO comedy special Delirious, which, for again, for my money, one of the best stand-up comedy specials of all time. That special leaves me in absolute stitches.
And it's really, like, you know, just looking at it, it's like we're talking about 7 years. Yeah. We're talking about 7 years in terms of release dates between 48 Hours and Harlem Nights. And these are, I mean, I don't even know how to explain the importance of movies like Trading Places. I like Beverly Hills Cop, but I loved Beverly Hills Cop too. That was, I was 10 years old when that movie came out. I had the novelization for that movie.
Oh,
I think in some ways, I think in some ways it, I wish I still had it, but it was like the type of thing where like, wow, there's a book for this. I want that too.
Yeah.
At 10 years old. Yeah, seriously, the young me was big on Beverly Hills Cop and Fletch, but I still argue that in some ways Cop 2 is better than the first one.
I think that I would agree with that, and I think that's kind of slowly become the consensus, right? I mean, you had Tony Scott behind the camera. There certainly was it definitely wasn't a carbon copy of the original. No right. ways about it. I mean, this was a different energy that put definitely the action at the forefront with the comedy coming up right behind it simultaneously. So I think it just has this this energy that's definitely lacking in the original film. Not to say that the original film isn't great.
Oh, the original film is great. It's just I do have to assert the series ends at two. There's two of those movies, and yeah. I don't want to hear about anything else. Even though it, apparently Cop 4 is listed as in production or announced, but
It's supposedly happening. I believe Netflix did broker a deal, and I think that they're going to be the ones that are going to be hosting it. So yes, I mean, if that kind of, I'm open to it because I think that Murphy, you know, just in the last few years, he's had quite a resurgence, and I love seeing that guy, especially when he's on fire in a similar way to what he did during the 80s. Again, this 7-year kind of arc that we're talking about, you know, we've mentioned Trading Places in the first two Beverly Hills Cop. He did have Best Defense. Let us not forget about Best Defense, which
I've never seen.
I've never seen it either, but Murphy himself called it the worst movie in the history of everything. So if that's not a reason for us to be watching that tonight, I don't know what is.
Well, yeah, it's also a Dudley Moore movie in the period of time where like Dudley Moore had Arthur and then like a whole bunch of movies that were not Arthur, basically, or Arthur 2 on the Rocks, where it's like, well, maybe being an alcoholic wasn't that funny. Okay. You know, but
okay.
Nonetheless, yeah. But nonetheless, so I'm curious about the worst movie in the history of everything. But I mean, you know, 48 Hours to Trading Places to Beverly Hills Cop. I have to rewatch The Golden Child. Because that's my weak one. To Beverly Hills Cop too.
Revisited it. Yeah, because Paramount just put out this new Blu-ray line entitled Paramount Presents that they kind of give these really nice additions to, and of course, as we'll obviously establish too, Eddie Murphy was a huge, huge player in Paramount Pictures. He was one of their golden stars. So he'd made a lot of his biggest and best films for them. And The Golden Child is an interesting one. I think it's got a very similar, it's definitely a departure. I mean, I think at this point, Eddie was definitely challenging himself to do different things here. And it's got, it's certainly a comedy where he plays like a social worker, and it's got mysticism in it and a magical element. That film, it's weird, but I really kind of sandwich that film into a very exclusive pile of films that kind of deal in similar marshes. I would kind of put it in the same stack as something like Big Trouble in Little China or Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Sure. It's got similar things with that. I like it. It's not one of his best from the era, but it's still fun and it's certainly different. And then, you know, again, after following Delirious in 87, he would make Eddie Murphy Raw, which was another comedy special that he filmed at Madison Square Garden and released. That thing ended up grossing $50 million. Can you imagine a stand-up comedy feature film going wide across the country and making that kind of money today? Like, that's, again, the power that Eddie Murphy had. Like, you can't even wrap your head around something like that.
I mean, and if there was, you know, I know there's going to be people who will defend what Eddie Murphy was in the 90s, his output in the 90s. But if, you know, I think it's almost like you can allow for the fact that the 90s were going to be a different time for him because he couldn't maintain that level of stardom. Yeah. I mean, that only flares up for so long. You're only going to be on like in that spot for so long until, you know, until you keep deciding to, you know, record singing albums or something. Yeah. As he insisted on at that time.
As he insisted on, which he made three albums. You know, probably the most popular was from 85, How Could It Be, which featured Party All the Time. But what I didn't know, he obviously appeared in Michael Jackson's Remember the Time video, and they were good pals. You know, Eddie, of course, you know, kind of mocked him jokingly in the Delirious special, hilariously. Sure. But he, in his 1993 album, Love's All Right, he did a song with Michael Jackson called What's Up With You that it didn't chart or anything, but that's still pretty monumental that he got Michael Jackson to be featured in a song with him on his album, which is pretty crazy.
Which makes me automatically think of Rockwell's Somebody's Watching Me, which has backups by Michael Jackson, which is easy to pull off if you're Berry Gordy's son. Anyway, I digress.
Yeah, and that's like, you know, just coming off of Raw, that would, of course, you know, snowball right into Coming to America, which is his reunion film with John Landis. And that was obviously a very contentious relationship, creatively speaking. I think that they made great work together, but there was just always something kind of getting in between them. There was definitely a creative tension, I think, so much to the point where I'm pretty sure Murphy said publicly, it could have been even at a press conference, that he wouldn't, he said that Vic Morrow would have a better chance at working with Landis again before he did, which is obviously a pretty cold-hearted comment to make, of course, in lieu of the Twilight Zone tragedy that happened. But yeah, he said that after the making of Coming to America. But again, these two guys couldn't exactly quit each other because we're rolling in, you know, rolling into the 90s. Again, this is a period where I think that me and you and, you know, most like-minded people can say that this was a bit of a downslide for Murphy's career. You know, this is obviously, you know, a decade where he did Boomerang, which I have not seen yet, but I've actually heard things. That's a film that's certainly coming around more.
I have to see, actually, to tell you the truth, the friend who also grew up loving Harlem Nights, who was talking me up on Boomerang the other day. I don't think I saw it, but his main reason was you have to see it just for Grace Jones, which I mean, I know not to argue with. I will obey anything in terms of Grace Jones, but that's not necessarily a reason to see an Eddie Murphy movie. But it's interesting to me that Another 48 Hours is the movie right after.
Yeah.
Right after Harlem Nights.
Right.
And it was very obvious even before Cop 3, the movie I like to believe doesn't exist. It was very obvious. And this is also the period of his second album. His second album, I think, came out in 89. And he was trying to push his second album. Yeah, it was very painfully obvious for me, you know, being, you know, having been born in 77, 10 years old in 87, during the middle of his reign and what have you. The 90s were a different time. You know, it's especially, you know, in terms of like some of the biggest icons of the 80s, especially like, you know, Schwarzenegger, Stallone, and Eddie Murphy, they were all like, things were changing dramatically within the space of like 4 or 5 years.
Yeah. And that's like an interesting time. And I will make a little commentary on the sequel that shall not be named, apparently. but yeah, I mean, this is, you know, we're entering the 90s here. And again, like you're saying, this is a different time. You know, the things are changing in the industry and amongst these people. I think that Murphy kind of hit a little bit more of a bit of a downfall than, say, like Schwarzenegger or like Stallone. I still feel like the 90s were pretty prominent for them, like, you know, Schwarzenegger, you know, had T2 and Stallone had Cliffhanger, you know, like they still had these big franchises that were very, or, you know, these big tentpole films that were really built on them. And for the most part, those were succeeding. Whereas with Murphy, he was still trying to challenge himself and do different things. You know, 1995, he worked with Wes Craven and Vampire in Brooklyn, which again sounds like a winning combination, but Wes Craven wanted to make a comedy because he needed Eddie Murphy, whereas Eddie Murphy had been doing comedies for about a decade plus, and now he wanted to do a more serious horror movie. So they kind of sort of meet in the middle there, and it's a little bit uneven, a little uneven. But
I know it has its fans. I have to admit, it would be wise and adult and mature of me to put fresh eyes on a bunch of this stuff from that period, especially Life, which you recommended recently.
Yeah.
But I just the family, I could not have been more turned off in my 20s and late teens by his turn to family fare. I had no interest in it.
Yeah, like that. It's a weird time. Like the 90s is a weird time, but something worth sort of examining in Murphy's career for sure. Of course, the sequel that shall not be named, Beverly Hills Cop 3. This is the reunion film, the final film between Murphy and John Landis. And it is, it is really better off not worth considering part of the franchise, which is really tough to say because not only is it the third installment, but we're basically bastardizing a film that features John Saxon as a villain. I mean, that's just a little hard to swallow.
But I think everything I've heard about this movie was like, and it's mostly from the actors was, we didn't really think it was very good, but it was so much money. Like we did it because they paid us to do it.
Yeah, and you know what? And Murphy has been completely transparent about that. I if I'm not mistaken, this film came out in 1994. If I am not mistaken, Eddie Murphy's salary for that was $16 or $17 million. Now, I understand that a lot of people say, "Oh, well, they're just doing it for the money. They're just doing it for the money." And you know what? I've never had a problem with that. If artists work and give us so many great, incredible films like Murphy did and stand-up comedy specials that are, of course, now considered classics. If a guy ascends to a part in his career like that and wants to take one or two or even a few for the money, I see no harm in that. Whereas average Joes, like, do we catch shit if we're like, you know what? I'm going to take some overtime at my shitty job. Like, I don't really want to do it. I don't particularly like my job, but like, I need some more money. No one's like, do it, man. Like, whatever you got to do, like, do it. But anytime that somebody's like a big Hollywood star, if they go on record saying that they did something for the money, it's now like, oh, it's like a big federal case. So I like that Murphy was very transparent. He's like, it was just a lot of money. Like, and that's good. I mean, Eddie Murphy's got a lot of kids, so like that's awesome.
Sure, like, sure.
He's got a lot of mouths to feed, so good for him.
It is, I'm the first person to say it is a business, and it is a business that relies on having an enormous amount of money to back projects. So, yeah, I don't use it as a form of judgment. I just find it interesting when that comes up over and over again to explain. To explain something that's been derided,
Yeah, for sure. And so that is obviously that kind of, caused that franchise to fizzle out sort of rightfully so. But then right in the smack dab in the middle of the 90s in 1996, we see a real breakout hit of Murphy kind of returning to form with The Nutty Professor. Just a completely resounding runaway success. Again, another film that Murphy would collect a $16 million salary on, might I add. And again, kind of, swinging back to what he kind of perfected in Coming to America, playing several different characters under tremendous amounts of makeup. I think that movie is really hilarious, and it kind of seemed like it would have been a bit of a restart back to, his funnier 80s era achievements. But then, as you alluded to, he transitions at this point to making more family fare, like films like Dr. Dolittle, again, another $17.5 million salary. and its 2001 sequel. He voiced a character in Disney's Mulan. And then he would take on the role of voicing Donkey in the Shrek franchise for almost a decade, from 2001 to 2010. And look, Shrek, as Dino knows very well, I'm a big Disney enthusiast, and I've always just sort of had this gripe with DreamWorks films. I've seen the first two Shrek movies when they originally came out, and my problem with DreamWorks animated films, not entirely, but the vast majority of them, they always felt like they were trying to chase a fad that was happening at the time. And they so many of their quote-unquote classics like Shrek feel so terribly dated now. If you were, if you recall watching Shrek, I mean, the film starts off with All Star by Smash Mouth over the opening credits, which if that doesn't spell 2001 for you, I don't know what is. There's a lot of like, you know, jokes being made at the expense of like the Matrix's bullet time. It's like, does that even play for kids? Like, do they even understand what any of that stuff is? Is it even funny anymore? But even more tragically is that those films, at least I feel like, it always just felt like every feature that they came out with, as soon as they hit, there was always like talk of several sequels in the works. There was a TV series being developed. There was always just something. Whereas Disney, they may have been pondering these things about each and every single one of their films behind closed doors, but there was always like time involved. There was always a distance between many of their films. Not all of them, but the overwhelming majority of them, there was distance. So you always felt like there was a lot more care and attention, whereas DreamWorks, it kind of always felt like they were chasing just like huge movies, and it kind of felt a little gross. And again, perhaps, I know I'm going off on a bit of a tirade on these, but the thing that I think kind of sucks about the Shrek franchise, again, only seeing two of the four, is that it Mike Myers obviously voiced Shrek, Eddie did Donkey, and Cameron Diaz, of course, voices Fiona. It sort of made all three of those performers really lazy. I just feel like once they started, you know, voicing the Shrek movies, they did a lot less work, especially Mike Myers. I mean, he really did. In that period of time, I think one of the only things he did, which was a real return, was he appeared in Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds. But can anyone, like, how many people can really say, oh, what movies did Mike Myers do between 2000 and 2010 that weren't Shrek movies? Like, I think a lot of people would come up with a blank. So I understand that these are big, important films for people that grew up with them, but I always just felt like it really made those two guys specifically very lazy because, you know, they were big franchises for kids. And then, again, the family cycle continues with things like Daddy Day Camp and Disney's The Haunted Mansion. And they're all hits. They all made money for people, but they weren't the Eddie Murphy that we all know. The Eddie Murphy from SNL, all the way up to the feature that we are eventually going to be talking about, Harlem Nights. But
eventually, yes.
Eventually, yeah. And you know, just to really wrap it up, you know, like, it was at this really, this real crossroads, I think, in Murphy's career, where he made several films in the mid-2000s, like Norbit and Meet Dave, Imagine That, and Tower Heist, that were just probably one of the, you know, the biggest fall from graces that you could possibly imagine for somebody like Eddie Murphy that had like the comedic stature that that guy had. You know, these films were constantly landing him countless Razzie nominations. They weren't critically, you know, hailed. Fans seemingly hated all of them.
I don't think I've seen any of these movies, and it's hard for me to not be interested in something called Tower Heist until I look at I'm a sucker for heist and caper and crime movies, similarly to the way that you're a sucker for Disney movies.
Yeah.
But until I look at Tower Heist, then I realize Brett Ratner made it. It's a comedy, and Ben Stiller is in the lead.
Yeah.
It's got Alan Alda and Judd Hirsch in it, and so whatever. But I'm not lured to see it nonetheless.
This is really where, you know, things were really going off the rails, which is a shame too, because just prior to this, like, you know, this long list of real like critical misfires, he got nominated for an Academy Award in Bill Condon's Dreamgirls, which was a real, you know, 360 in his career, and you know, a really fantastic performance where he played the role of James Thunder Early, you know, surrounded by people like Beyonce and Jamie Foxx, a really fantastic film. He did win the Golden Globe for Best Supporting Actor in that role, rightfully so. So you'd kind of figure, oh, he's stepping into dramatic things, or, you know, he's going to try something new and really surprise us. But alas, it kind of went downhill. And after
he basically pulled a Burt Reynolds, you know, after Burt Reynolds did Boogie Nights, and it's like, oh wow, you're back and you can do these mature roles.
Yeah.
And then what happens? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. We just got a bunch of films that were pretty awful from every indication. Yeah. And I think that this is something where Murphy definitely took seriously, because he more or less went into a hiatus for several years. I don't think he intended it to be several years, but it was roughly about 6 or 7 years. And I think that he had this urge to prove, like, I'm not ending off my career on like one bad note where everybody thinks I'm the worst thing. So he kind of picked himself up and, you know, kind of refocused and recalibrated himself. And of course, with that, we got the really sensational Dolomite Is My Name in 2019, which was just fantastic. An absolute crime that he did not get nominated for an Academy Award for that. This fantastic biopic of Rudy Ray Moore.
Liked it a lot. I am a Dolomite fan. Liked it a lot. I liked it a lot more than I wanted to. I just wish it had a theatrical release that was much more significant.
I agree. That's the only bummer thing. I mean, I know that the New Beverly played it on 35mm, because of course they would. But yeah, it wasn't like, you know, I think it was very small, you know, major cities might have gotten, you know, a very small run. But yeah, that film certainly deserved to be on a big screen. But I loved it. I loved it. I just watched it again a couple weeks ago. And that, of course, leads into Murphy resurrecting the role of Akeem in Coming to America, which, again, it's not fantastic, but everybody, including Murphy, is having an incredible time. So that's, you know, that accounts for something, I think, but it's certainly not Coming to America. But that sort of wraps up Eddie Murphy, I think. And, you know, again,
can we go back to A Nicer Time of 1989 now, please?
Yes. Can we please? Yeah, because we kind of put everybody through the mud of you know, the late 90s, 2000s, the Family Fair rut of Murphy's career. But that
I have to
go
take a shower to get all the Disney off me now. Sorry, you asked for it.
Yeah, we are definitely rolling back the clock. So with all of that out of the way, it's no secret that Eddie Murphy is obviously a force to be reckoned with. He's a comedic legend. And the film that we are going to be talking about really does come at the tail end of this monumental decade that he had, right before things started to ebb and flow, if you will, for him. So, without further ado, 1989's Harlem Nights.
In 1938, the Nights belonged to Harlem. The place to be was Club Sugar Ray's. The man to know was Quick.
Now, when you see Quick, I suggest you guys make plans to go elsewhere.
Yo, I ain't afraid of going up against Smalls or Calhoun.
That's because you're young.
Come on!
Full of vigor.
I work for Mr. Calhoun.
What kind of work do you do?
Whatever's required.
What would a woman that fine want in a big, fat, nasty, greasy, 12 sandwich eating? What does she want with it?
She likes fat guys.
Eddie Murphy, Richard Pryor, Red Fox, Danny Aiello.
It's nice to meet you.
Michael Lerner, Della Reese, Jasmine Guy.
I'd like to go upstairs.
Arsenio Hall.
Oh, Quick is mine.
Gotta stop overreacting.
Overreacted?
Harlem Nights.
I thought I was the only person who slept with his guns under the pillow. Look at that little gun. Oh.
Coming Friday, November 17th at theaters everywhere.
Harlem Nights, 1989. Mike, it's your first time. I could talk about this movie, but I want to know how did you do with this 2 days ago when you first watched this 1989 movie for the first time?
Yeah. Well, again, just to reiterate, yeah, this was I think a sizable kind of empty slot in my Murphy filmography viewing habits, to say the least. Yeah, initial thoughts, I loved it. I thought it was great. I thought it was an absolute blast. Yeah, I just thought it was so great. Like, I really enjoyed it. I can't believe that it took me this long to see this film. You know, a period piece gangster film starring Eddie Murphy. But not only starring Eddie Murphy, written by Eddie Murphy, executive produced by Eddie Murphy, produced by Eddie Murphy Productions, and directed by Eddie Murphy. So to say the least, Eddie Murphy was juggling several different creative hats on this film, right?
And he was also kind of cashing in on all the success he had had in the years before that, because this has like passion project all over it, you know, written all over it. It's got a significant amount of guest stars who are either his friends or family or fellow comics. And seriously, if we were not still in the pandemic, and we're between the two of us, I think we're three quarters immunized at this point. But if it was not the pandemic, I'd pretty much would have showed up on your doorstep saying, "We're going to fucking watch this, and I'm waiting here until it's time for us to watch this together." I this is one of those movies I would have loved to watch with you.
Yeah, this is definitely that's a good point, because this is definitely a hoot to watch with people. I could imagine. I mean, I watched it by myself, but I was in stitches during the greater majority of this film, as you know, this is the peak decade for Murphy. So to have that sort of a reaction to a Murphy film from the 80s is not uncommon. In fact, that's exactly the sort of reaction you want to have when watching a Murphy film from this era. But yeah, this was great. This definitely was a personal project for Murphy. And I think it was sort of like a challenge to himself. He wanted to see if he could direct, if he had the chops to pull it off. And although, the reception to the film, critically speaking, wasn't exactly what he was expecting. And he sort of, I think at the time, sort of hastily wrote it off. And he said, well, it doesn't really matter because I directed it to see if I could. Clearly I can't, so I'm not going to do it anymore. He said something along those lines, which I think was just kind of, you know, I think that that was just very live frustration, because I think that he can direct. I think that he's actually a pretty apt director. I think that he handled himself pretty well for a first-time filmmaker. I just love that this is something that he wanted to do. He always had a desire not only to direct to see if he had, you know, the chops to do it, but he always had a desire to specifically make a period film. So it's very cool in that manner. I guess just to give a bit of a rundown, this film takes place, it first kicks off in 1918 in Harlem with Richard Pryor's character, he plays Sugar Ray. And what would you say that is? He kind of controls and owns like a nightclub that's sort of like a, you know, there's like backdoor card games, gambling going on.
It kind of has after hours speakeasy type vibe to it. And the character, you know, the character who's supposed to be a childhood version of Quick, Eddie Murphy's character in the movie, appears and first really comes into contact, or first time we see contact between him and Richard Pryor, Sugar Ray's character, over a crap game in the back room. Red Fox is there. I should note this. Ronaldo Ray is in that scene.
Get out of here.
Who's an interesting character and a guy who pops up in movies at different times, but he's probably the first, next to Red Fox, he's probably the first comic that you see in this movie. He's shooting craps next to Red Fox. Ray's also in Rage in Harlem. White Men Can't Jump. He's involved in BB's Kids. More on BB's Kids in a bit. House Party 3 and Friday, but he's got this interesting, like, he's passed away, I think, 2015 or so. Ray has this interesting career, not just being a comic, but having writing credits and musical credits as well. So he's the one of the first people we see who pops up in this movie in an incidental role is a character that he's a pretty light-skinned guy. He's the kind of guy who probably gets roles named Red or what have you. But he's the first person for me where I'm like, that guy, what do I know that guy from? So that's at this crap game. And then basically what happens is the guy who's shooting the craps at the table at the time freaks out because the kid is there. and basically ends up being shot by Quick's character,
which was an incredibly surprising and kind of took me aback that moment. But I was like, okay, this is a very different beast that we're dealing with now. I love that. I just like that, you know, from the opening scene, it kind of like subverted my expectations. And then
and we're already seeing Pryor like do his thing. We're already seeing Pryor, like, you know, there's the confrontation with the guy and he's like, I gotta tell you something, wait, I forgot, because he can't find the pistol and what have you. You're already getting a bit of Pryor's chops, and they're strong. He's old. He's maybe not as sharp, but he's not supposed to be, because he's kind of a middle-aged character at this point, you know.
Right.
And so then go ahead.
Oh no, I was just saying, I think that sort of chemistry, I mean, he's very much now I people might have some misconceptions just by, you know, simply looking at the poster art for this film and seeing Eddie front and center. You know, Eddie is certainly the star, but I wouldn't even go so far to say that Richard Pryor is playing second fiddle to him. I feel like there's a really nice balance between the two. I really feel like I think that he handled that where it's not Eddie kind of hogging every single frame of the camera in this. Like, I feel like when you're fully invested in Pryor's character, you're really invested in him and you're following that story and how, you know, eventually after this scene that we're just talking about, we jump ahead 20 years to 1938 and Pryor's Sugar Ray character has, of course, taken Murphy's Quick under his wing, kind of taken him in as like an adopted son. And it's 20 years later, and now Sugar Ray has this really, you know, this happening sort of nightclub that attracts predominantly the African-American community in Harlem, but not exclusively. There are, you know, it seems to be like anybody who wants a good time knows to come to Sugar Ray's. But yeah, I think that the film does a really good job in not making it solely about Eddie Murphy. I think that it balances it really nicely, whereas you might think, oh, Pryor's just there simply to support Murphy. I don't see it as that. I don't know how you feel.
I think you're on point with that. And I think that's fair. There's so many people in this movie, but it's not a vignette movie, but it's also not strictly about Quick. It's not about Eddie Murphy character. It really does feel like he's sharing. A lot of the spotlight with Red Fox and with Richard Pryor, mm-hmm. though Pryor, his role kind of shifts a little bit. I think he has less to do as the movie goes on, but. But I think you could see in the way it was written and the way that they made it that they're aware of the generational differences and the differences in age between these three men, and they play to it. I just want to quickly say a couple of the movies you're speaking of, black cast period films, and of course there are many. But some of the ones that came to mind, you know, I always think about the 70s. And there's a few I've forgotten that I should have mentioned here as well. But Lady Sings the Blues, of course, from the early mid-70s. Book of Numbers, which is the only movie directed by the only movie directed by Raymond St. Jacques.
Oh.
Which is actually like a period. Two waiters go to Arkansas to become like number runners, or to build like a policy like empire. Mm-hmm. Strangely enough, that movie and the soundtrack album were both sponsored by Brut by Fabergé, the fragrance. Strangely enough, so it literally says a Brut Films is like the card at the beginning is a Brut film. It's okay. It's not amazing, but it's interesting exercise. A much more obscure one, I think it's a Code Red disc, Baby Needs a New Pair of Shoes.
Yes.
Also a Depression era movie. And not great. Of course, I use the term black action a lot, but in terms of like a lot of the black film renaissance, the black film eras of the 70s, a lot of the subgenres get overlooked.
For sure.
Like the black cast horror material. The black coming of age stories and, you know, period stories. And of course it should be noted that this movie is made not long after the enormous success of The Color Purple.
Yeah.
In terms of a period film. But, So now we're in 1938.
Yeah. We're in 1938. at that point. And as you said, Quick and Pryor's character Sugar Ray have kind of come up. Sugar Ray's club is doing increasingly well, and it's at that point where a rival gang member who we'll meet a little bit later, Bugsy Calhoun, who's played by the great Michael Lerner, who's appeared in things like Busting and Newman's Law, Strange Invaders, Maniac Cop 2, a whole slew of things. A great supporting...
Anguish,
1987's Anguish, of course. Yeah. He's a great supporting actor. So he sends one of his cronies to Sugar Ray's to scope it out, and walking hand in hand with this guy is Jasmine Guy, who she plays a role, Dominique LaRue, who we would see in Spike Lee's School Days, and of course, Television's A Different World. They come out to kind of scope out Sugar Ray's and kind of assess the profitability of this place. And they go in to kind of shake down Sugar Ray to say, if he wants to keep this club, you know, he's got to get, but you know, he's got to, you know, kind of send a cut to Bugsy Calhoun. And Bugsy Calhoun is sort of the top of the food chain as far as the gangster world is concerned. So Sugar Ray thinks there's no point in kind of, you know, outstepping this guy. He's just going to pack it in and move on, then fighting with this. And then, of course, the arrogant and kind of feisty Quick says, no, like, we can't do that. We're not going to give this place up. So then from that point on, I think the story continues to sort of unravel at that point, right?
Sure.
Again, there's so many prominent people in this film that upon ending this film, I think that this was one of the best assemblages of Black actors in any film. I just thought that the casting all around, I think this is one of the best films featuring a predominantly Black cast that I've ever seen, frankly.
I completely agree, and it to me, it just gets stronger upon repeat watching. It's not simply the Black actors, to be fair. It does have the incredible, like, my appreciation just gets greater and greater for Danny Aiello.
My God, he's great in this.
In an asshole role, he's fantastic. You know, I have to admit, Vic Polizos is fantastic in this. He plays the Richie Bento character.
Yeah.
And I, you know, maybe I don't lean as hard on the Italian American actor interest thing as I could, but he's in like well over 100 titles. Yeah. He has well over 100 credits. And he's just, again, one of those guys who, oh yeah, he's that guy. He's the coroner in Night of the Creeps, the coroner who keeps eating the whole time. And he's also in Chud, strangely enough. But he's fantastic in this as the sap. The character who, as a white guy who is just running money for the white mob, gets completely suckered by design by Lila Rochon, Sunshine, her name is.
Yes.
and the scenes between the two of them are actually like, I think they do really great. They're, neither of them is a major player in this movie, but they have really good comic scenes together where Leila Rochon is basically, just stringing the character Richie Vento along because he's supposed to fall in love with her, and she does the batting her eyes and the hushed voice and the whole thing, and it's totally playing with the idea that crossing the color line is extra scintillating and whatnot. Leila Rochon is interesting too. I don't think she ever really took off, but
she did work with Murphy again in Boomerang, which I thought was interesting. Again, another film that neither of us have seen, but she did work with him again. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. No, but she's had quite a career. She's married to Antoine Fuqua.
Oh wow.
And I think they have two kids together. But she was previously married to Adolfo Quinones, Shabadoo, which explains in part why she's in Breaking and Breaking 2. It doesn't explain it per se, but perhaps they interacted on those.
I saw that in her filmography, and I was like, how'd that work?
Yeah, she's in Waiting to Exhale. I mean, she certainly had a moment in the 90s. She's in Any Given Sunday, kind of a notable piece of late 90s filmic excess. But it's at least. But you know, it's a role in a pretty major movie, gang related, and something called The Wild Pair. Did you see this from 1987? It's a buddy movie with Bo Bridges and Bubba Smith that's directed by Bo Bridges.
Why are we not watching that right now?
Because we have to finish
I Eat Movies for. That's correct.
So yes, yeah, I don't know what that movie is. That movie might not know what that movie is either. But I'm certainly intrigued in The Wild Pair.
Yeah.
But yeah, honestly, like I'll get some character stuff out of the way here. There's so many people in this, and that, you know, yeah, I can talk about Danny Aiello, but everyone knows Danny Aiello. The most important thing I would have to say is this movie has one of the most important things that he did. It has a Danny Aiello yelling scene. Yep. He does yell about how angry he gets that they're so rich and he's living in a fucking hovel.
Yeah.
So great. That's like checks off a major box. But some of the people that, you know, might be somewhat more overlooked. Don Blakely shows up, our man Don Blakely from our prison episode. He pops up as a crap shooter. Mm-hmm. And I think this is towards towards the end of his career. Robin Harris, the great Robin Harris,
great Robin Harris, yeah.
Total rising star. He acted in 5 movies before dying at 36 years old of a major heart attack. The five movies. Think about this period of time. And for me, this is like, this says everything. Besides Harlem Nights, is in I'm Gonna Get You Sucker, Do the Right Thing, House Party, and Mo Better Blues. So he's
I
in.
Love Mo Better Blues. Love it.
I have to go back to it. I love early Spike anyway. And I mean, Do the Right Thing to me is a generational cornerstone as far as I'm concerned.
For sure.
You mentioned Tommy Ford, Thomas Michael Ford, who plays Tommy Smalls.
Yeah.
Best known for his run on 132 episodes of Martin, but is now directing and producing. One of my favorite guys who I feel like never really got the roles he could have, you know, he deserved or could have really blown up with, Miguel Nunez. Yes. Miguel Nunez plays, I think, Man with Broken Nose.
Yeah.
There's this, there's different groups in this movie, and one of the groups is headed by and definitely stolen by, I think, Crying Man, as played by Arsenio Hall. Arsenio Hall is apparently brothers with, Tommy Smalls, the Tommy Ford character,
who is Ford, working for Bugsy Calhoun's kind of unit.
Yes, he gets shot, and then I think his throat is cut. The Arsenio Hall character, Crying Man, discovers Quick leaving the house, decides that Quick has killed him, and then goes on a crusade, crying, bawling the whole time.
Yes.
So Miguel Nunez, I should just get this out of the way. Miguel Nunez would be instantly recognizable for his playing the role Spider in Return of the Living Dead. Mm-hmm. But he's also in the Cannon film Dangerously Close with Whoopi Goldberg and Jumpin' Jack Flash. He's in Action Jackson, Lethal Weapon 3, Street Fighter. And then he became one of Eddie's guys, it seems, because he's in Life, Pluto Nash, Nutty Professor 2, maybe one or two other later Eddie Murphy movies. And of course, he did have, this is one of those, I have the tape and I still haven't watched it. Mm-hmm. He did have a starring role in a movie called Juana Man, where yes. he plays, which is a cross-dressing kind of, you know, gender flip kind of character. But still one of my guys anyway.
He's great. Also appeared in Friday the 13th, 5, A New Beginning. Those damn enchiladas, as many people will remember, as he's infamously in the Portageon when Jason attacks. Again, like we can't say it enough just how many colorful characters comprise this film. Just a few more. Also, Stan Shaw is in it. He plays the boxer, Jack Jenkins. He appeared in
the great. Like Yeah, great, great
like
yeah.
just so good, like just such a presence. Now, he is a boxer, that the guys are going to be betting on Bugsy Calhoun and Sugar Ray. It's just a big racket. Everyone's, you know, putting money on this big upcoming fight. And Jack Jenkins is the reigning champ. When he speaks, I can't help but feel like there's a bit of a Mike Tyson thing going on. He has like a noticeable lisp and he's very slow. It's very funny. He's very slow, you know, just due to like, I'm sure, countless strikes to the head where he's slow in his responses. Terrific.
Well, he can't put words together. Yeah. He can't get words out. And it's not exactly a stutter as much as like you said, he has like, probably cognitive, synapse damage from his head getting pummeled so much. But he is the champ, and everyone's like, "Hey, champ, how's it going, champ?" And
yeah,
I think was it Jack Jenkins? I think his name
Jack
is
Jack Jenkins. Yeah,
yeah.
Great.
Stan Shaw's just, I mean, you know, he's had such a long career. Another guy who I wish got a few larger roles. But he goes back to Truck Turner. You know, he's in Truck Turner as well.
Yeah, he's really fantastic. And then again, we're probably one of the biggest people in this that we have not mentioned yet. At Sugar Ray's, of course, it's a big gambling hall. People are having a good time. And then in the back is a bit of a brothel area.
It's not a bit of a brothel. Who is running the hose at this brothel, Mike?
Who is running the hose is the one, the only Della Reese, who is just fantastic. And again, this is one of those things, going back to what I said about Richard Pryor not exactly playing second fiddle to Murphy. It's all of these, you know, these big people, Pryor, Red Fox, and Della Reese, I would put into this category for sure. These roles, they really, every time that they're on the screen, they make these moments their own. Probably the biggest and most memorable moment is when Della Reese's character Vera has a bit of an alley fist fight with Eddie Murphy's Quick.
Hold on a second. It's not a bit of an alley fist fight. She beats the shit out of him. Okay. and I mean, okay, so there are other female, we've talked about the three male leads. There are other females in this movie, like I mentioned, Layla Rochon, Berlinda Tolbert is in it, another senior, not as senior, of course, as Della Reese, but another senior African-American actor who goes back to the 70s, and I think she's in one of the airport movies, but no woman in this movie comes close to Della Reese, who is steals
force of nature.
So it's notable that she is supposed to be, I guess, married, or you know what? It's left open probably for a reason. She and Red Fox have some kind of long relationship, which basically we see comprised as them cursing at each other. You know,
yeah.
Her telling everybody to kiss my ass, and of course, kiss my entire ass.
Yep.
In one point, notable scene that literally a mutual friend of ours has been saying to me for the past month and a half since we announced this. But she and Red Fox were best friends for like 40 years.
Wow.
And immediately, you know, after this movie, they were doing a television show together, which was called, what was it? It was the Royal Family.
Yeah.
That I think Red Fox only managed about less than 10, maybe 7 episodes of. And true to form, just like, you know, just like the Fred Sanford character, he dies while he ended up in the hospital. I don't think he completely died on the set, but he literally, I think he had a heart attack, clutched his chest, and it took a minute for people to realize he wasn't acting. He wasn't doing one of his bits that he did constantly on Sanford and Son. So there's a story about Della Reese taking like a bunch of the cast to see him in his last days in the hospital after that event. Mm-hmm. And I think he died a couple of days later. But Della Reese, okay, so I don't know where to begin with Della Reese exactly. You know, unbelievable career. You know, she was singing as a teenager. She She was what she got a really lucky break. I forgot. I'm gonna forget who it was. I mean, she has all these. There's all these bits of her career, like Soupy Sales introduced her to the TV format. She started drinking. She started singing, you know, gospel. She is the youngest performer ever at 22 years old to match the vocal range of some of the great jazz singers like Ella Fitzgerald or Carmen McRae. And then she just did an enormous amount of television. I mean, she. You talk about the 70s, she did at least 20, 24 episodes of Chico and the Man, but like an enormous amount of like television shows and movies as well. She was a minister. She's always, I mean, I get very annoyed when words get beat up and start to lose meaning. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people don't realize this, that if you use a word enough, it starts to mean nothing. And in English, especially our English, we have so many words that it's time to start picking up another one. Right. We can record another podcast no one will listen to about my feelings about the word curate. But Della Reese deserves the role diva. Not every woman deserves the role, the term diva. She lived through some shit. I mean, there are stories about her like, I don't know, like I guess cutting herself open like severely through a plate glass window, surviving a stroke. I mean, this woman has been through some shit, and I think that's also written into her character a little bit here. Yeah. You know, like Red Fox is like, you know, they're going out to the alley for this fight scene, and Red Fox as Benny goes, "Be careful, you're messing with a heavyweight." Yeah. And she's got all the lines, all the snaps. Quick does not take her seriously, and Quick has casually accused her of stealing.
Yeah.
And Vera is not going for it.
Yeah.
And he basically has to shoot her pinky toe off to stop her from handing out an ass whipping. So it's not a little fight, but yeah. Della Reese destroys every scene she's in.
And again, this is, I think, a credit to, I think, Murphy's directorial style here. These are such gracious moments this guy is handing out to a person like Della Reese. He does it with Pryor. He does it countlessly with Red Fox. There are so many significant moments. Danny Aiello, again, like that, the moment that you spoke about before. There's so many great moments where these people have their time to shine, and it's really their time. It's not necessarily being anchored with Murphy being there. They have scenes that are really built up on them and them alone. So again, I think that that's a testament to Murphy's directorial style. I guess we won't really know, because this is, of course, the only thing he's ever directed. But yeah, just to kind of jump back into the plot, back into this, where we left off, Bugsy Calhoun is, of course, trying to, you know, twist Sugar Ray's arm into selling out the club. And Sugar Ray doesn't want to go up against him, whereas Quick wants to fight this battle. You know, they built this thing up. And you really feel like there's a blue-collar mentality for it. You don't really get as much as Quick, you know, from being a child to literally murdering a guy, shooting him in the head. Mm-hmm. You know, they are quote-unquote gangsters, but in the movie, you don't really perceive them as law-breaking, sort of society-destroying gangsters. You don't get that. These are, like, good-time guys that you feel like they really worked for their piece of the pie, and at least in Quick's point of view, he's not ready to just hand it over for nothing or to anybody. Least
our sympathies are definitely with them. They're definitely the protagonists, for sure.
Yeah, yeah, 100%, 100%. This is not a simple, like, gang war type movie where we're like, oh, everybody's like this jaded anti-hero. It's not. Like, you know, Quick, Sugar Ray, like, these are the guys that we're rooting for through and through. So from that point, you know, of course, you have Bugsy Calhoun's people kind of, you know, estimating the profitability. And then people, you know, it becomes abundantly clear that Quick and Sugar Ray are not going to let up. They're not going to just hand over what they've rightfully built up for themselves. So it becomes this sort of cat and mouse thing where Bugsy Calhoun and his cronies are trying to get Sugar Ray and Quick's guys, and then just a ton of really delightful sequences unfold on how they get back. Obviously, Jasmine Guy's Dominique LaRue's character plays heavily into that. You see a bit of a flirtation, a sort of a sexual tension building between Quick and her. That obviously builds because Dominique is obviously working for Bugsy Calhoun. And that goes into, of course, Quick kind of playing it cool, going over to her house, gets lucky with her. And again, in sort of another moment that kind of pulls the rug out from you, Dominique pulls a gun or attempts to pull a gun, a very cute, tiny, pretty gun.
A gun that Quick earlier kisses in a moment of cuteness until he realizes it's the little feminine pistol that she's intending to kill him with.
Exactly. She attempts to do that, and then, you know, shortly after the two of them have sex, again, Murphy just shoots her in the head, just point blank. Again, another, like, it's cold and savage, but you don't, like, you don't fault Murphy's character for doing it.
And there's no gore there. It's what has to happen, and it's edited perfectly to the next scene, to literally like a book closing at the point at which you would hear a gunshot. So it doesn't really you know, it's a little shot of severity of reality, but it doesn't really interrupt the comic tone, the rolling along. That's the thing about this movie. It's like, this is an easy movie to put on and just kind of watch, you know. It keeps moving, maybe not at a breakneck pace, but it just keeps moving forward, and it kind of has its own groove to it.
Yeah, absolutely. I would fully agree with that. And then, of course, moving on, this kind of gets into the third act, at least in my opinion. I sort of feel like once we get to the third act, there becomes, I feel like a bit of like the plot gets in the way of the story, if you know what I mean. There's a lot of like plot dynamics going on here where this boxing match that we've alluded to before, Jack Jenkins, Sugar Ray, you know, everybody knows that Jack Jenkins is going to win. Everyone's betting their money on it. But Sugar Ray decides to put money on the other guy. So then there becomes this sort of like theory in Bugsy's mind that, oh, they're putting money on the other guy because Jack Jenkins is going to throw this fight, costing Bugsy and his cronies a ton of money, which does not seem to be the case. And then it becomes this whole sort of idea where Sugar Ray now, he wants to leave, but he wants to ensure that his people, everybody around him, is taken care of. So they devise this elaborate thing to kind of, wipe Bugsy's fortunes out. I think that's safe to say, right?
Yeah, this is the part of the movie that seems to have a bit of the Sting influence to it.
Yeah, definitely. And at that point, I feel like at the third act a little bit, it gets like there's just a little too much plot trappings that are happening. You know, it just gets a little too plot heavy where, again, this is a great scene. Again, another very gracious scene with Sunshine, as we talked about before, where she's sort of flirting with a numbers taker for Bugsy, and she's going to switch bags of heroin with the money, you know, Bugsy's earnings from the fight and stuff. And, you know, cops come, and Sugar Ray and Quick are dressed as cops to kind of take it. Danny Aiello is tailing them because, of course, he's a corrupt detective for the city working for Bugsy. His character, Aiello's character, Phil Cantone, to an abandoned bank where they lock him up over the weekend. It's all part of this big elaborate plan. And that's kind of where this is the only part of the movie where I just feel like there's a lot of plot trappings like that, where they're just trying to throw a little too much in to kind of make sense of like what the big takeaway is, or how Sugar Ray and Quick are going to kind of like, you know, double cross Bugsy or get away with everything. It gets a little muddy there. Not terribly. It certainly doesn't take away from the greater good of this film by any means.
I think there's a tonal shift there. I get that. I think that you know, that there's all the loose ends that they've built up, these, you know, the Arsenio crying man character and his friends have to be killed. The Phil Cantone character has to be taken care of. The inherent Honestly, I
it's like explaining like how they have to cover all of their bases. I think that's what I'm saying. Like there's so right. much of that where so much has been established with these great antagonists, and now we're to the last act, and now it's like, okay, the film has to resolve how all these guys are gonna get off scot-free. So that's where
honestly, I think that smooths out a good bit after like a second or third watch. I see what you're saying, and you're right. I definitely think that it doesn't change the momentum of the movie, mm-hmm. but it becomes a movie you have to pay a little bit more attention to for
Which
this
is fine,
final
yeah.
act. Yeah. Yeah, if you're just looking at this as a good time movie, and like I said, seeing this in the theater, if you're just waiting for Red Fox to show up and start talking some shit again, it might be like, wait, what's happening now? But yeah. Again, it's yeah, it does have that scene. It does have that amazing scene where Eddie Murphy, where Quick is telling Phil Cantone how to save his breath in the bank vault, which usually gets a pretty good laugh. And then the movie continues, and they've figured out the heist and the double cross for the heist, gotten the cop off their back, and our main characters are then seen in New Jersey. Or something. Is it really? Do they say Hoboken?
Yeah. The motel that they're at. I noticed that. I forget what the hotel's name was, but it says Hoboken, New Jersey, which makes sense because they're right across the water.
Right. It's a very Hollywood version of that. But it does make sense because they're looking. It's totally like New York City. Harlem's in the rear view. There's not going to be another Harlem, but they can't stay in New York now, et cetera, et cetera. And that brings about the end of the movie. Really.
Yeah. And you know, again, just to reiterate this, I mean, this is one of the best predominantly all-black casts that I've ever seen in any film. I mean, just the chemistry, the graciousness that Murphy gave to all of these performers to really shine in their respective moments. It's incredibly funny when it wants to be. It's exciting from a gangster perspective, like the period piece. I loved the flashiness of this production, which at the time, this is what I thought was hilarious. And of course, this is just, you know, it's all perspective. But one of the criticisms that this film got was for its production design. The production design, for those who don't know, was handled by Lawrence G. Paul, who did things like Romancing the Stone and Back to the Future, Escape from L.A. One of the criticisms that this film had was that the production design they felt lacked style. I don't know what movie they were watching because
I don't see that at all. Yeah,
I don't see that at all. And another again, this is all perspective, but they said that it didn't feel like a true representation of a period gangster film for, I guess, that demographic. I guess they assume that, I guess, people, you know, a gangster film that is comprised of a predominantly African-American cast should be taking place in, you know, sort of a dingier territory or perhaps the ghettos. However true or untrue that may seem, I like exactly what Harlem Nights did because we've seen a million movies like that deal right. with people of color and minorities that take place in the ghettos and whatnot. I liked that these guys were... they were established. They were flashy. They drove flashy cars. They had like beautiful suits, like the costume designs, which were provided by Joe I. Tompkins. He was nominated actually for an Oscar for this film, and rightfully so. He did stuff like Howard the Duck and Species. But yeah, the costume design in this film is fantastic. But that's exactly what I like about Harlem Nights so much, is just this grandiose sort of like extravagance to everybody's design and look. I mean, it's certainly high times for these guys, you know, it's fantastic.
And it was high times. Look, it was high times for Eddie Murphy. It was definitely high times, or, you know, closing out a major era for Pryor and Fox. And, you know, look, why wouldn't Eddie Murphy, this is a passion project, and he had his name on so many of the major roles from directing on down, why wouldn't he make it more of an extension of himself, an extension of the fact that this is a movie largely populated by comics and musicians? It's not going to be like the hardest, coldest drama, and I don't think it was ever designed to be. But I think it's also very—it's also interesting that a black cast, film like this, you know, coming through like the early '80s, it was, again, The Color Purple is the anomaly. But after like all the major black cinema of the 70s, there was a real serious drop in the late 70s into the early 80s period, you know, a period of time when you know, Pam Grier was reduced to like much smaller supporting roles and what have you. Like, this is kind of a return to form for the black cast, or mostly black cast film, after a pretty dry period. And that's significant. And I think it is served with style. I think this movie would make a really good pairing with The Untouchables from only a few years before it.
Oh, absolutely.
Does it have exactly, you know, maybe as lavish the filmmaking, or, I mean, it's a pretty high budget movie, Harlem Nights.
Yeah. It was budgeted at $30 million.
Yeah. But you know, is it made the same way as a De Palma movie would be? No, of course not. It's a first time director, right. But Untouchables is not a comedy. So, but to me, this is one of the ironclad movies that I will always ride for 100%.
Yeah. Remembering, like, Murphy not only starred in this film, he wrote the script, he directed, he acted as an executive producer. And for anybody that's jumping in, I don't care how successful you are in acting or comedy, to make your leap to directing and to direct a period piece, no less, I mean, that shows a lot of fearlessness and balls, really, to jump into that, because these are waters that you don't necessarily know how to navigate, least of which, you know, with period, and you're trying to establish, you know, a camera movement that serves a period story and whatnot. And Murphy, I think, that just dived into it. It's such a shame, because as much as this film was kind of really critically destroyed, this film debuted at number one. It's easy to mistake that as if it was like this big immediate bomb, because it wasn't. It collected $60 million domestically. It made $95 million worldwide. But
it was mostly considered a bomb because they were comparing it against his last few movies.
Right, exactly, which are nothing like Harlem Nights.
And his last few movies were certainly not directed by first time directors, much less director, producer, actors.
Right, exactly. And that's where the divide comes from. I mean all that sort of bad press is not indicative of, as you've heard us ramble for 90 minutes, it's not indicative of what we see in this film. And, you know, again, just the critical, you know, negativity towards it was so uninformed, and then it would go on to get nominated for 2 Razzies for worst screenplay, worst director, and Murphy actually won for worst director, one that I don't think he deserved. But the film would actually win worst picture at the Stinky Bad Movie Awards, if you remember those. Yeah, they got discontinued in 2006, but just like terrible, because it's not at all. Like, how do you stumble upon this sort of film? It just feels like they saw that Murphy was at the top of his game, and there's always just people that want to like tear you down when you're at the top. Clearly,
there's a lot of stuff in this period that look. I really bemoan the lack. I bemoan the death of the professional reviewer. I really wish we still had those people. But yeah. That said, this is, you know, this period of time. Like, I couldn't believe how far and wide, for, you know, the derision, the bashing of a movie like Ishtar was at the time. Like, it was a punchline that crossed all formats of media. And another one where, like, if you watch that movie, it's actually pretty good. It's actually decent. Yeah. But nonetheless, like, you know what? I don't really give a shit about the reviews on this movie. No. Again, I know there's a bunch of people that if I say you shot my pinky toe to them, they're going to know exactly what it is, and they're going to be laughing about it also. Like, right. This movie is built on, I can't imagine a better group of people who, you know, really strong comic performers, really strong performers in general, upon which to build a movie, especially your first movie. There's nobody in this film that I'm like, oh, so-and-so could have done that better. I feel like it all works. I mean, even down to Charlie Murphy showing up and
his first role
and Uncle Ray Murphy. Well, yeah, Charlie Murphy actually has lines in this.
Yeah, it's great.
But yeah, you know, it's
good. And it's a shame, because I think Murphy definitely beat himself up about it. I mean, in retrospect, he looked back at Harlem Nights and he thought that he didn't dedicate enough of himself to the film's direction. Instead, he felt like he was more concerned about, you know, when the next party was happening. It's a shame because, you know, like, I think that there was a lot of promise here for Murphy, and I think I would have been thrilled to see where he went, directorially speaking, in his career. But of course, you know, I the bad press and everything, I guess it kind of shied him away from ever stepping behind the camera. A loss, but what we do have is a really great, you know, bookend to this phenomenal decade for Eddie Murphy. And it kind of rightfully ends with him kind of juggling all of these creative hats. I think that it's like really, you know, it's really poetic that it ends with him stepping behind the camera for the first time, doing something that he really wanted to do, a period piece with something he always wanted to appear in. Oh, before we kind of end off on this, how do we go this whole time and not talk about the great Herbie Hancock score? Just fantastic.
You know, I have to, that might be the shortcoming of still watching my tape copy. I think it's good. I can't stop and visualize it being drawn in by the score just because of the way I've always watched this movie, looking for the next point at which I can watch Arsenio crying and screaming with a Tommy gun or whatever, or Della Reese, you know. Love that little scene with Della Reese in the kitchen. I just hate silly shit. Who leaves the orange juice in the fridge or just a swallow in the container?
Who leaves that much?
Yeah, but it's like it does have those little human bits in it. I think it's decently written, you know. Yeah. And we've done two episodes in a row with a first time director that never directed a feature film again.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I don't know what that means.
Yeah, I don't know what that means, but
we've got exquisite tastes here at IE Movie.
Only the best. But yeah, I mean, like, I am so happy that decided on Harlem Nights for my first time on an episode like this. This is certainly a format that I hope that we continue.
Absolutely.
I hope that we can introduce Dino to something that he hasn't seen that I seem to like a lot. We're going to do some digging.
We can, we've already come across those. Look, you know, this came up at work the other day. It's like, I don't want to do that shit. It's too easy with either records or with, oh, what do you mean you don't know this band? What do you mean? How have you never seen that? You know my reaction already. I literally am like, first of all, if I had seen every single movie, I would be even more intolerable than I am now. Okay. and secondly, and this is real. This is like, I really am impressed when people tell me they haven't seen a movie that I haven't seen because, or that I know well and I you know, I love or whatever, because it's like, fuck, I would love to see it with your eyes. I would love to sit next to you. Like, some people, some dear friends of mine, they really hold, movies are private. They want to focus, be alone or whatever. I am the type of person where I want to be with somebody when they watch a certain movie for their first time. Like, because I think that's fascinating. I love seeing how people react to things. I hosted a million movies at Alamo, and I would tell people at some of the most cult movies, like, look, I know, I would ask for a show of hands sometimes. I know we have people here who are seeing this movie for the first time. You love this movie. Don't ruin it for the other people. You know, think about how important this movie is and think about how important your first time was for you. So the first time idea, I'm definitely ready for it. And there's so much stuff I haven't seen, so I'm fine with that.
I love that too, because I think we've talked about that before, especially in the last few years. I've really enjoyed that part of, you know, whether it be at the Mahoning Drive-In or Alamo or elsewhere, you know, talking to one of your buddies and they just openly admit, like, yeah, I've never seen this. Like, this is my first time, and it's something that maybe we've enjoyed for decades. It's one of our favorites or something like that. Instead of where most movie fans, again, might, you know, kind of, you know, annoy their friends about how they couldn't, or, you know, make them feel crummy for not, you know, seeing this. I get so much delight and enjoyment out of knowing that. I mean, the several times this last season, there was several films that were some of my favorites. Yeah, several films that were some of my favorites that friends were like, oh, this is my first time seeing it. It just always evaded me. And I was like, I'm so excited that we're sitting next to each other. Like, I'm so excited to, like, see your reactions and know after, you know, the end credits hit, like, what you thought. Like, so it's great. I thought that this was This film in particular, Harlem Nights, was a total blast. I'm so happy I finally caught up on it. Fantastic recommendation by our co-host, Dino.
Thank you. Awesome. All you had to say was I'm a big Eddie fan. That's all I got, buddy. That's all I got.
That's it. Yeah. I mean, that's all we can say. Again, all that bad press that this film got during its initial run, not at all indicative of what this film is. This film is flashy. It's funny. It's exciting. It continues the peak Murphy that we meet at the beginning of this decade, I would dare say.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I think that all about wraps up movies number four, right?
I think we're good.
I think we are good.
We're going to go back to a double format next time.
Yeah, we're going to go back to a double format next time. What that is, you guys will have to stay tuned to our social media outlets to find out. But we'll have something good for you, certainly.
We got a whole bunch of stuff always. So.
Oh, we got tons of stuff. Oh, boy. We got tons of stuff to spoil you guys with. But yeah, until that time... We just want to continue to thank you guys for tuning in to I Eat Movies. We love hosting it for you. Definitely check us out on Facebook at I Eat Movies and as well on Instagram. Dino?
I Eat Movies Podcast. And like us on any podcasting service device, what have you. And eat more damn movies.
Eat more damn movies. Yes. Until next time, guys, we'll see you. Thanks, Dino.
Thank you.